This is the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Piccini. Today's GP Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Number One Soccer Camps, Fearless and Capable, Coaching Positional Soccer, Perfecting Tactics and Skill by author Michael Curlis, and GP Voiceover Services. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast, Season 6 Series, The State of the Women's Game, a comprehensive look at the women's game here in the United States. Well, hey there, everyone. This is Giovanni Piccini, your host of the GP Soccer Podcast. I want to welcome all of my fans, all of the show's fans from, well, north, south, east, west, everyone in the middle, and all of the international fans and followers of the show around the globe. Welcome, welcome. You're in for another great show today, another great interview guest. I've been so lucky, so fortunate. I say it all the time, but it's so very true. Over the course of the last five seasons and now five seasons plus, because we're into season six, the state of the women's game, the theme this season for GP Soccer Podcast. I've had some wonderful guests, some of the most important voices in the game, both nationally and internationally, and even local as well. A great many people have contributed to the show, and today is no different. Our interview guest in the second block of the show is Candice Fabry. She's the founder and owner of Fearless and Capable, and you're going to find the conversation I have with her very enlightening and very moving, and we'll get into some very important and sensitive topics as we go through that conversation with Candice Fabry. It's something that I think you're going to enjoy, and you're going to learn a great deal. So that's in the second block of the GP Soccer Podcast, but once again, welcome to all of you. I want to start the show first and foremost with a hearty congratulations. Congratulations to our U.S. Women's U-20s for winning the CONCACAF Regional Championship with a 2-0 victory over Mexico. Our goal scorers are Michelle Cooper early on in the third minute, and Talia Della Peruta with a PK toward the end of the first half, and that's 2-0 scoreline held up against a very capable Mexican team. This age group has done extraordinarily well. This is their seventh U-20 CONCACAF title. If you watch any of the games, you follow the team, you follow the games, the future looks very, very bright for our women's national teams programs. The young group of ladies who are playing the game, in this case here, the U-20s, are terrific. We now see our full women's national team undergoing a bit of change with bringing in some younger players and integrating them with some of our seasoned players. So we're getting a chance to see, in our full women's national team, some of the new up and coming stars, which, I believe will keep the United States of America on top of the global soccer scene. So congrats to our U-20s. I want to spend a moment in the opening block here talking a little bit about the NWSL, the National Women's Soccer League. And you know, when you follow the history of women's soccer, professional soccer in the United States, it almost mirrors what happened on the men's side. Now, on the men's side, the history goes back quite a ways. And I'm old enough to remember most, if not all, of these men's professional leagues going back, and my chronology may be off by a league or two or a generation or two, but you'll get the gist here. I remember going back to the NPSL, the National Professional Soccer League. During that time, they used to literally import full teams from primarily in England to come here to the United States and play quote unquote professional soccer in our summer months, which is their off season and in many cases their preseason. The NPSL then made way to the NASL, and first incarnation NASL. We also saw the American Soccer League. We know, the North American Soccer League at its height in the 70s and 80s with the famous New York Cosmos, with Pelé and all the great players that came to play for the New York Cosmos. And then we saw, well, we saw no men's professional soccer. But there were a lot of leagues that eventually led to the current Major League Soccer. And we've learned lessons from way back in the days of the NPSL and the early days of the NASL and ASL and all of the leagues like that to now a very strong, a very capable Major League Soccer. And on the women's side, again, history is not as long, but we have the Women's United Soccer Association, the WUSA, W-U-S-A, started in the early part of the 2000s, about 2003. And then from there, we went from the WPS, the Women's Professional Soccer, from 07 to 2012 to the current NWSL. And much like MLS, we now see a women's professional league that is on pretty solid ground, pretty solid ground. Are they making boatloads of dough? Are they making money? In a lot of cases, no. Same can be said for Major League Soccer. But the stability, the foundation, the things that are necessary to bring the professional league going forward are certainly in place. And then in the next or the now new portion of that, which helps the stability and the long-term planning of the league, is the naming of the new commissioner, that being Jessica Berman. She was recently named the commissioner for the NWSL. She comes with an amazing background. She'll be the new commissioner as the NWSL starts its 10th season of play, 10 years. She will start her four-year term as commissioner at the end of April, April 20th. And in that time, interim commissioner Marla Messing will hold down the fort. She's done an absolutely wonderful job, if you know. Her leadership in sports industry includes serving as the president and CEO of the 1999 FIFA Women's World Cup, and she's done a magnificent job as the interim commissioner of the NWSL. During her five-month tenure, she's credited with negotiating a joint investigation with the NWSL Players Association, resolving the Washington Spirit ownership situation, which can only be termed as ugly. We had issues with then-coach Richie Burke. We had issues of verbal and emotional abuse by Coach Burke, racially insensitive comments, a lot of very, very ugly stuff. And then in other situations, we had a number of situations where they're just inappropriate conduct by head coaches. And it was messy. It was ugly. And Marla Messing was very instrumental in overseeing the investigation and all of that. And the sale of the Washington Spirit as well as overseeing the collective bargaining agreement. And then kind of restoring the long-term prospects, literally and figuratively, of the league going forward. And as I said, Jessica Berman will start her role on April 20th, and she's got a great background as a deputy commissioner, executive vice president of business affairs with the National Lacrosse League. She spent some time in the National Hockey League, served as vice president and deputy general counsel for the organization, and she became the vice president of community development, culture, and growth with the NHL. She's a graduate of Fordham University School of Law. She has worked in the labor and employment sector. Essentially, she's got a background in sports. She's got a background in business. Maybe most importantly, she's got a background in law, which, in dealing some of the issues that I noted will certainly serve her well. But the women's game is coming along well. We see it in salaries. The average salary for players has been up 66% since 2019, which is terrific. The salary caps in the NWSL, starting in 2013, where the salary cap was just $200,000, is now up to $1,000,001. And as things move forward for the league, much like MLS, ladies and gentlemen, the future looks bright for the league. The future looks bright for our young women players who are looking to play professional soccer in the United States, and the capacity to make an equitable dollar for their efforts on the soccer field. So, we had some ugly times, we had some difficult times, we had some challenging times in NWSL, as I noted. We've kind of turned the corner, and through capable leadership, in this case now, with Marla Messing serving as interim, and now the new commissioner, Jessica Berman, things look rather terrific going forward. I'm excited for the women's game. I'm excited for the for the professional league. And I'm going to put it out there, and I do this all the time because I'm going to be provincial here, because we did have professional soccer franchise here in the Boston area, the Boston Breakers. And I would love nothing more to see the return of the Boston Breakers, or a women's professional soccer team here in the Boston area. So the unofficial word goes out to those in the Boston area. If you've got some deep pockets and you've got some vision, I think Boston should, it must have a women's professional soccer franchise here in the New England area. The amount of soccer that's played here, both in the boys, girls, men's, and women's side here, particularly here in Massachusetts, is absolutely phenomenal. It's a great soccer market. I'm preaching to the choir out there who are familiar with the women's game here in Boston, here in the New England area. But there seems to be, not seems, there is a void. There is a void by not having a women's professional team here in Boston, Massachusetts. So I hope the message resonates. I know there are challenges, particularly with stadium issues. It plagues the New England Revolution, who still play in the cavernous Gillette Stadium. And I know efforts have been made, terrific efforts by the Kraft family, to secure a soccer-specific stadium in the city of Boston, and have faced challenges, not the least of which is a location. There's not a lot of open space in city proper to plant a stadium. But nonetheless, the work goes on. The vision is maintained that we can get a soccer-specific stadium that will eventually house and be the home of not only the New England Revolution, but a future NWSL women's professional soccer franchise. Let's hope. So that's how I want to open the show, by offering congratulations to our U20s. Talk a little bit about the NWSL. Exciting news with Jessica Berman. And once again, we're going to get into the interview block with Candice Fabry, the founder and owner of Fearless and Capable. This is Giovanni Pacini. You know that. This is the GP Soccer Podcast. You know that as well. We're going to break for a couple commercial messages from some of my great sponsors. And on the other side, my conversation with Candice Fabry. Don't you dare go anywhere. Like any good soccer coach, it's a pretty safe bet that you've got quite a collection of coaching books in your library. Well, no library would be complete without Coaching Positional Soccer, Perfecting Tactics and Skills. Author Michael Curlis has compiled an impressive soccer manual for both beginner and experienced coaches. Coaching Positional Soccer includes 160 diagrams depicting practice activities, 70 hand-drawn sketches that detail the neuromuscular approach to learning the exact body positioning and movements of each soccer skill, practice planning organized around phases of play, coaching elements, and player principles to help deepen your player's understanding of the game. Specific coaching interventions are provided for each activity to help coaches identify the most common player mistakes. Practice plans that are organized into training modules to ensure that previous learning is incorporated into current learning, so the team style of play expands from week to week. And finally, the manual includes a team progress rating form to measure your team's improvement. This is as comprehensive a coaching book that you'll find anywhere. So be sure to pick up Coaching Positional Soccer, Perfecting Tactics and Skills, and add it to your coaching library. Hey, this is Giovanni Pacini. You all know me as a soccer coach and a clinician, but did you know that I'm a professional voiceover artist as well? I own and operate GP Voiceover Services, and my voice has been heard on radio, television, and over a variety of media platforms. Anywhere a voice is needed to tell your story, promote your organization, or bring words to life, GP Voiceover Services is your choice. I have a background in radio, have appeared in professional video productions, as well as having hosted cable television programs. I will work with you before your production to understand your preferences and plan just the right approach for your project. I also offer private consulting and training for those interested in exploring the voiceover profession. To learn more about GP Voiceover Services, visit my website at gpvoiceoverservices.com or email me at gp4voiceover, and that's the number 4, at gmail.com.
Hello, this is Anson Dorrance. I'm the women's soccer coach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I am here on the GP Soccer Podcast with Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I'm your host, Giovanni Pacini. Welcome all of you back to another great episode. This has been a boatload of fun. This has been an opportunity for me to learn quite a bit, and I'm going to learn quite a bit more today with our guests, who I'll get into in a few minutes. One of the great things about doing this show is that, as you all know, if you're a regular listener, you know this. I've had countless wonderful, wonderful guests, many of whom are my friends and my colleagues who, they take the time to come on the show and we talk all things soccer. But there are times, like today, where I'm meeting someone for the very first time and I'm learning about their lives and their backgrounds for the very, very first time. And the great thing about that is it kind of expands the folks that I know in the game. And it's a great opportunity for me to kind of stay connected with these folks and like I said, learn more and more about what they're doing. So that's one of the coolest part about doing the GP Soccer Podcast, having my friends and colleagues on and now having some new friends and colleagues of which we have on today. So with all that said, our guest today is Candice Fabry. Candice is the associate coach of the Kansas City Courage women's team, which is a professional amateur team in Kansas City. She's a coach of the ODP team at 2008 girls and a Midwest regional coach with the 09 boys and the 08 girls. She's a U.S. soccer grassroots coaching instructor and the owner of Fearless and Capable. It's a mentoring program that's supporting female coaches, referees, and administrators. So Candice, with all of that said, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I as well am looking forward to getting to know you. I've heard the name and I'm fairly certain I've seen you present a handful of times, but getting to have a discussion and chat today is something I'm looking forward to. So thank you again.
I'm just a nice Italian kid from Boston. How about that? Nice Italian kid from Boston.
I love it.
So Candice, here's where I like to start with all of my guests, because I'm fascinated. I know my listening audience is fascinated. I'd like to know about, your life growing up. I know you're from Illinois. You mentioned you're outside the Chicago area. What was it like for you growing up playing soccer or participating in sports? How was that, an important part of your life growing up? Did you have any athletes you looked up to? Did you have any mentors? Did you have folks who you kind of inspired you to follow a particular path? Share with my audience your life growing up as a young person playing sports or playing soccer.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So to take one step back, I was actually born in Kentucky. So imagine I'm 5 years old in Kentucky, where soccer at that point wasn't extremely prevalent. I was the oldest of three girls. Neither parent played soccer, really knew much about it besides it was a sport out there. And I am signed up to do ballet, I believe. And apparently I was a bit of a naughty girl. And apparently part of the punishment was I was not going to be able to do ballet. I don't know what, why, or anything. And my mom still can't remember exactly the reasons. But long story short, I feel like regretted that decision not to put me in some sort of activity. And so when they went back to the park district, the only thing that was open was soccer. And I was put onto a team, with a lot of boys. I think I was the only girl for a couple of years on a team, and slowly worked myself from complete shy girl, I guess, on the field where I never touched the ball to, lack of a better reference, the Tasmanian devil running around the field as, just as aggressive and just as excited about the game as the boys, which obviously made my dad pretty excited. And my mom was super supportive of me doing and playing whatever was exciting to me at the time. And so we moved when I was about 6 or 7, so pretty early on, to Chicagoland area, and grew up in Naperville, where soccer, is extremely, extremely popular there. And then obviously across the Chicagoland area. So quickly joined clubs there and got into playing pretty much year round, was an ODP player, was a part of, the Naperville Soccer Association, and then moved over to soccer's about my middle of my high school year, just because at that point I knew I wanted to play in college, and playing with players that were like-minded in those goals was something that was important to me, and my parents respected that. And so, did that and played and drove, an hour plus in Chicago traffic. And that was kind of the deal, is once I got my driver's license and my dad was adamant that I learned how to drive in Chicago traffic. So I'm not quite the person you want to be in if you're worried about traffic and safety on the thing, because I'm a Chicago driver at the heart. But that was the deal. I had the old Nokia cell phone and was able to have the junky car that I drove to training. And that was really where things were starting to kind of come together for me in terms of knowing that soccer was going to be something that was never going to go away. It was a big part of my identity through high school and so on. But knowing I played, you know, an hour plus away for a higher competitive club, high school for me was pretty much at school and then on the road going to soccer. And so socially, definitely, you know, was the kid that missed dances, the, you know, the girl that wasn't available to go to parties. It was just soccer pretty much 24/7. And I loved it. And moments I didn't, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like everything was, you know, roses and all that, but there was definitely injuries and there was frustrations. And so as a young female player, you know, I was looking up to the national team. And at that time too, not realizing that, you know, after college, what would be an opportunity to play? And I really didn't see, and probably was pretty self-reflective, myself ever playing on the national team. You know, I had friends that were getting invites in the national team on my club team, and I was not. So I was like, okay, I see the difference in playing level. It's not for me. But at the same time, I was actually already coaching. So I was doing, I was putting flyers together in my neighborhood and running individual sessions. I was coaching my sister's 3v3 teams. I was helping out at the club, at camps and so on. So I was already coaching in a lot of ways, and I was also refereeing. So any money-making opportunities to pay for gas and all that were coming around soccer. And so that was really my life, and was fortunate enough to be offered to play at a Division I school at the University of Toledo. And that was, you know, a really great opportunity. And I started, though, in my senior year to feel some pain in my back. And we were trying to figure out what was going on. And sure enough, at the end of my freshman season of college, I had played every minute and was, you know, had a great, great season, but I was in so much pain. And that's where they found a stress fracture in my back. And that's where things started to kind of flip, that definitely knowing the playing was not going to be a something that would last too much longer for me. And that was part of it. It was, you know, kind of looking back at all of these years of playing in the Chicagoland area, playing for clubs, playing with my friends, but understanding that that time was coming to an end pretty quickly for me. But what else would I do to keep myself in the game? Because that was such a big piece of my identity growing up.
So you graduate from the University of Toledo, and You're obviously involved as a player growing up. You're involved. You've already started coaching as a young person. You're officiating. So you're now you're a college graduate. And do you go out there and get a real job, as we like to say sometimes as coaches? Or did you continue following that track, that passion that you had already kind of delved into as a young player where you already started coaching? What was the professional track upon your graduating from the University of Toledo?
Yeah. So I thought I'd be a teacher. So I was going through that pathway of the plan was I was going to teach social studies at middle school or high school level, and then I would be like the high school soccer coach. And that was partially because every coach I had ever had, and I was fortunate, I had female coaches, I had male coaches, I had female coaches that had babies, you know, I had the gamut, and I had great coaches and I had horrible coaches that, you know, aligned with some of the issues we're all facing today, hitting the press about, you know, behaviors and so on. I experienced all of that. But you know, when I looked at the collective of what I knew my identities would be, and I got into the classroom to start student teaching, I believe I called it the field. I believe I said something like a huddle. Like, it was, the terminology was not fitting the environment I was in. And that was my sign that I love teaching, but it's not in the classroom for me. And so that was my kind of aha moment. And I said, again, my freshman year, we found the fracture and we made the decision based off of the needs I was trying to have medically to be able to play again. We redshirted me sophomore year. And that's where I was able to get a lot of the coaching, you know, pieces and parts. I talk a lot when I do public speaking and talk to young women and talk to leaders of clubs and programs. I remember the dry erase marker being passed to me and asking me to put the starting lineup in my opinion. And I remember that moment because that was that first like tingle of, this is really cool. Like I could see myself doing this. And so I talk a lot, and I say metaphorically, like, who are you passing the marker to and asking their opinion? Who are you mentoring and passing that marker to? And so those moments in my sophomore year were kind of setting that up. And my coach, I had, you know, expressed that coaching was something I was interested in. And so at the end of, or the spring of my senior year, I actually took my D license through US Soccer. So I hadn't graduated college yet, but I had gotten my D and knew that this was a path I was going. So once I figured out the aha, I'm not going to be in the classroom, I don't like the walls around me too much, and then had taken this coaching license, it really started to open my eyes that this is the path I wanted to go in. So I started working with a youth club. I volunteered at the college I had played for. I did have, in quotes, a real job. So I was working in a PT office, like doing bookkeeping and, you know, filing and all those types of things. Part of that was trying to keep me healthy. It was fun because I could use sometimes the machines and keep my body healthy from the injuries. But then I could also, you know, be able to fit in the schedule of coaching and so on. And so from that point forward, I have had very small blimps where I am not 24/7 soccer, where, you know, all the hats that I do wear are not soccer. And it really set the course for it. Now, my parents, that was a different discussion. They were like, so what are you going to do? You're going to be a college coach? I'm like, yeah, not really. I'm going to do like club, and then I'm going to do this and that. And oh, I'll do ODP. And so they were like, how are you going to make enough money? I'm like, I'll figure it out. So that was a little bit different for them, because they saw coaches as, you know, the high school teacher, the high school coach, you know, day job, come and coach night, or you're a college coach. So they didn't really see how a youth coach might be able to make this work. And so, you know, I was taking licensing through US Soccer every summer. I took the US Youth National license, actually with Vince Gansberg, and it was one of my most favorite licenses ever back in the day. It was awesome. And so it was really just figuring this piece out that this was what I wanted to do. I did meet my husband, and he is a soccer guy as well. So we're one of those soccer couples, which was great because we understood the schedules and the demands and so on. And so, you know, being able to support one another in our careers, we each have our own identity and our own passions within the game, but then to be able to, you know, understand the late night phone call or the extra work or whatever it may be, the session you stay after to talk to the players, there's just a mutual understanding that that's part of the job. And so it's been really a crazy path of a lot of different hats to wear to kind of get to today. But it was definitely a come out of college and going, I am not putting on any sort of suit, dress, anything, and sitting at a desk all day. That's not going to happen for me. And I've been pretty adamant that that's not happening ever. So
there's a couple of things I want to touch upon in your wonderful response there. Along the way here, and you're navigating your way toward a path toward coaching, you're taking coaching courses and you're coaching and all that kind of stuff. Along the way, was there a mentor? Was there a cheerleader? Was there a supporter? Was there a support network? Someone who was kind of, you know, cheering you on or guiding you on? Or was this kind of all discovering as it goes for you on your own?
So, yes, you know, one of the pieces to my story that, you know, is probably not the easiest, and one of the things that I'm open about is that the day that I stayed on to play at the college I had played for and coached, excuse me, so I was playing and I was coaching, I was actually sexually assaulted by my head coach. And so it was a really tough time, because at that time I'm trying to figure out who I am, what my identity is, and I didn't want anybody to know. Because when I looked around, I saw no females. I only saw males. And so I thought, who's going to believe me? Who, you know, he's been a coach of the year. I was just on, you know, the tournament team. Like, we had just made school history in so many ways. And so I was really in a spiral of, am I actually a good coach, or are people just pulling me in because of these other motives and things that were going on? And so that was a really, really tough time. But I did know I wanted to coach. And so I kept finding ways to get myself into other environments where I met other coaches and mentors. And so being in Ohio, I found Tom Turner, was one that was really, really great and brought me into ODP early on and was, you know, as transparent as Tom is with me. He's, you know, was a great mentor in my session building and did a couple licenses that I was in. He was a part of, or, you know, kind of an auxiliary, knowing that I was in the course and giving feedback. I had, you know, a couple other people that coached college because I was trying to decide a path of college and youth. And ultimately, honestly, my husband at first was a mentor. He still is in a lot of ways, but he was a mentor to me because he was also in the game and we were, you know, working together, and he was someone that was a bit older than me and had gone through the ranks. And so, you know, I opened up about the story and my doubts of, you know, and the struggles I was going through personally being, you know, in the situation where, you know, I've been assaulted and I'm trying to figure out who I tell or not tell and who's going to look at me, you know, in a way that would not be favorable for the next job. And so I, you know, demanded anyone I told to keep that secret, especially in the soccer world, because I wanted the next job. I wanted out, but I definitely wanted the next job. And these gentlemen, and they were all men, were really great in being, advocates for me, being sponsors of me in circles to say, no, she's a good coach, like bring her in, giving me additional opportunities, you know, meeting up with me to give me feedback, being there when I'm just crying or mad or confused, because those are all feelings you go through forever, as someone that, you know, experiences those types of situations. And so they were really amazing. And I credit a lot of them to get me through it. And then I also had a buddy, who runs a club out of Chicago right now and is a DOC, and he did all of my licensing with me, and he was always just that consistent, steady factor in all the licensing. So he was the guy that was my age and going through all the same growing pains of a coach. And so it was just really nice. I had really good people around me. They were all men. And so I'm a big proponent that there are fantastic, male allies and male mentors that females can have that really keep you in the game. But there's also the really bad ones. And so that's where, you know, looking at, and there's poor female mentors and poor females in the sport. So let's not, you know, dice this between men and women. It's not that. It's, there are people that do great things and there are people that make really bad choices. And so, you know, for me, I struggled to look around and find females that were not in the college game per se, were in the youth game. I knew I wanted to have kids someday. How does that work? You know, and so it was difficult for a long time to find people. And you know, to be frank and honest, those mentors I had and Tom and Paul and Eric and, you know, the friendship I had with Greg, like those have lasted to this day. But over the last probably 5 years, I have now started to find female mentors. And as an entrepreneur, as a coach, and in so many ways, I've started to find females in these small pockets and been able to rely on them as mentors for my growth and my own development that I see myself in the path I'm on. And so that's a really big driving force behind Fearless and Capable, is the fact that there are these amazing women out there that can be mentors and be supportive and have worn the hats, have been on the pathways, have been, you know, with some similar lived experiences to relate to. And how do we get these mentors to kind of spread that knowledge? But then on the flip side, knowing that as I've progressed and I mentor now in the Kansas City area, there's not that many females in Kansas City area that maybe take on that role of mentor. And so, you know, I only have so many hours in the day. Time is so precious. You know, I can't mentor everybody. So if we as women who are invested in the future of the game by agreeing to be mentors and sharing our resources kind of arm in arm together with the use of technology and the ability to virtually meet, we can honestly provide opportunities for mentorship, regardless of where you live, who you work for, you know, the position you hold. We can now give you that support, and you're not out there kind of looking around at your own environment and going, well, I don't know who to talk to. And, you know, at the same time, we're losing female coaches. I know it's a huge discussion point, but I've run too many courses now where, you know, just the females in the course are low at numbers. And then finding out, you know, within a couple of years, they're not coaching at all is really disheartening. And it's not always the environment, but there's a lot of discussions when they go back into their home environments, whether it be club, college, whatever, where it just is not something they find desirable. because of mentorship, because of the people they work for, and a number of reasons. But it's something that I think we can solve together. And so that's been a big piece, is that I now have female mentors in my life, which is awesome. And a lot of them are in the program because I've learned enough from them that they also need to share and express, and they're willing to. I think that's the big piece. So
first and foremost, I appreciate your being so open about being a survivor of sexual assault. And I want to capture the moment, Candace, so that those who are listening, whether they be an individual who has been victimized or they know someone who has been victimized, that we could take a moment and make this a learning moment, a teaching moment. So you're a victim of sexual assault. How did you wrestle with that internally? What were the internal discussions, the internal turmoil that you were experiencing post the assault? And how did it manifest itself? How did it appear, if you will? If it appeared at all? Sometimes it can get suppressed and it never manifests itself. It gets buried. How did it all work out for you? And then you've already touched upon this already, but how did you deal with it? And who were the key people, if there were any, that helped you deal with it to get to a point where, okay, I can talk about it. It's out there and it's behind me and I'm a better person for it.
Yeah. A lot. So there's the initial response to what happens, which is, what did I do? And that was a question I wrestled with a lot. And, frankly, that night, it's always tough because, we almost put play in our head. And so we see these moments and you wrestle with every little thing you may or may have not done. But like, I had come from training. I mean, I'm in a t-shirt and shorts and it's July. I probably honestly needed some more deodorant. Like, I don't understand, how it was even appealing at that point in time. But at the same time, I was in an element where I trusted and I felt safe, and that all turned on a dime. And so you question what you did and what you might have been asking. You're not sure your part in it. And so that question is something that you wrestle with, because the fear, and a lot of times for women, is that we're going to put this out and there is going to be questions to, well, were we asking for it? What were we wearing? What did we say? What did we do? And I remember being like, I was in a t-shirt and shorts and I probably stunk and my hair was in a messy, sweaty bun. And I don't think, I hugged him, but I've known him for 5 years, and there, to be honest, his wife was there at the restaurant. And so, what was going through? I don't know. And now I look back and I look at the facts and I'm like, it's so blatantly obvious. I didn't do anything. But it's hard at that moment in time. And so, there was a lot I didn't tell, the closest friends, because the closest friends are on the team. And so what would that do? And how would that go? And how would that go over? And if we do go tell, if he gets fired and everyone blames me, because he's a winning coach now and looked up to. So who's going to blame me if he gets fired? And what happens to his family that I've known for 5 years, years? So there's all of that that is all focused on him with no focus on me. And through that, and the manifestations is, for me personally, was, a spiral into my own depression in a lot of ways, not social. I was not working out. I was overeating. I was drinking more than I should have. And it wasn't healthy. It wasn't healthy at all. But like I said, I had these bright moments where I had people that cared and would, hey, you're invited to this. And can you make these sessions? Can you do this? And those were the bright moments. And I found, that was my release, but I didn't want anybody to know what was going on. But, people saw the differences. People saw changes in me for a long time. And so, I didn't take a lot of good, healthy steps in the initial part. And I eventually did tell my parents, because my parents were both, what is going on? And at this point, my parents are divorced. So they're collectively trying to understand what's going on, but they're not, together and when I'm having these discussions. And so I remember finally telling my parents a very abridged version, because I'm embarrassed. It's awkward. And of course, both parents are just massively frustrated and upset at him, you know, and they were amazing in their response, supportive, there for me and, you know, trying to get me resources and things to go to talk to people and report and all of that. And I was just like, I want to forget it ever happened. So just let me get through this and forget it ever happened. I'm going to find another job. I'm, you know, all those things. And so they were respectful of those wishes. But my mom's in the mental health field. She knew that this was not going to last long, but you know, at the end of the day, it was my path and I was the adult. She couldn't do anything in those ways. And so it would manifest in these really hard moments. So, you know, again, I'm working through the career and I never had a female boss, never had one. It was always a male boss. So how am I managing all that? Oh, I am like freaked out every time I'm in a space with them. I don't know what they're going to do. I'm, you know, making sure I have my safety net of people around me. I am not in a good space to personally deal with things, but I also have a really healthy relationship with my husband who then knows the situation and he's aware of everything. And so he's there and, you know, understanding and he's in the game. So he knows and you know, can sense when I'm in that zone of like, I can't deal with this. This is popping up in my head. But what ends up being kind of the release, is that I had, again, trickled out to some people here and there that just watch out, you know, he's done things, blah, blah, blah. And I get a call from someone who would have been a part of the program and said, Candace, you know, we've heard through the grapevine, you might have been a victim. And what I found out was there were several after me. And so that moment of two things, one, there's this relief of it wasn't just me. So that whole, what did I do? It was answered. It was never me. It was always him and just his nature. But the other piece is then this sickening, massive guilt of what have I done by not reporting? All of these girls, and some I knew and some I didn't, were also victimized. And I could have maybe saved. I could have maybe stopped it. And so that guilt is extremely overwhelming. And so I make the decision to tell the school what had happened way back then when, and sure enough, he was able to leave on his own terms. Things were not properly really investigated. But at that time, again, this is my first time kind of going to people that can do something. And I'm sitting there just going, I just want it behind me. I told you what I know, just put it behind me and move on with life. And so I think that's going to make me better. I've said it out loud to people that can do something and things have kind of been done, but it's never really all behind you. And so from there, there's this confidence that kind of grows. And so there's the Me Too movement And I remember the Brett Kavanaugh, you know, the situation where, you know, they're asking this poor woman, like, tell me, what were you wearing and what day of the week was it? Da, 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 da. And so I'm up at the early morning, you know, cup of coffee before the kids wake up. And I'm sitting there and I think about all these questions that this poor woman's asked. And I put on social media kind of the Me Too piece. And I tell everything I remember and the things I don't remember. And that post, I think, is still up somewhere. But it's, you know, I remember this. I don't remember this. I remember this. I don't remember this. And we have to start believing because that moment is so traumatic. Your body almost exits where you're at. And I fought back and pushed off and ran away. And you know, I didn't, and I'm not a hero for that. I'm not better for that. That doesn't make me anything different than any other, you know, survivor, victim, whatever you want to call us. But, you know, it's that out of body experience of what the heck is happening. And so, those moments are something that then carries into the professional field. And so when I'm getting more public and I put this social media post out, I now am looking around. I'm a little bit more secure in my job and what I'm doing. I've kind of climbed up a little bit. I have a stable job. I know there's people that support me. And then suddenly people are kind of looking at me just slightly different. Like I felt that shift because I was one of the first female club coaches, apparently, there's no data, but I was just told, to coach boys in Iowa. So I'm coaching youth boys in Iowa at this point. You know, I'm more involved in, and I'm that coach on the sideline that is tough and confident and, you know, borderline cocky and arrogant at times. And so you don't see this kind of, you know, broken shell. Everyone saw this tough, you know, outer armor that there's no way this is part of her story. And so that shifted the narrative for people to be like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, like I almost didn't do any of this because I was so broken to why was somebody thinking I was a good soccer coach when obviously their thought process was something different as it related to me. And so I had to doubt whether people wanted me in the game or they were looking to prey on me. And so that's a really hard piece to work through without support, without mentors. So having good parents, you know, being able to tell a few people that were trustworthy and then being able to, you know, find people that believed in what I was capable of and then putting me in these environments, giving me feedback, giving me trust to thrive and keep pushing me out there and saying, no, you are good enough. Get out there and go do it. Because they knew when I left the field, I was as happy as could be. That was my release, my endorphins. And so I've done I did the post, and then from there, it's just kind of started to snowball over the last several years. And I believe I publicly stated it in like 2014 or 2015. I can't remember the date right now, but it was about 7 years after I was done playing, that I had kind of first reported. And then, you know, the years after, I've been more public. I've been on podcast. I've been interviewed. I record it, for an educational video series for parents and athletes about what happens with abuse. So I've been really public about it, and I am much better in my daily recovery when I have to go into those moments and I speak about it. I tell constantly when I first would speak about it publicly, I mean, the rest of the day was shot. I was done. Emotionally felt like I'd run a marathon to have the hit play button and go through it. Of all the stories and the experiences, but then to think about all the stuff that I had gone through personally to try and manage it. And so once I started speaking publicly and I did it more often and I wasn't hesitant to tell my story on a personal side, you know, I work out more now. I drink, you know, here and there. I don't drink regularly. I have healthier relationships. I'm a happier person in so many ways because I finally didn't hide what the real story was. I was truthful and honest that this is part of my journey. It's a horrible piece that is there. But the part that's been the hardest, kind of coming out of the side of going, okay, my story's happened. It's never behind me. It's always a piece of me, but I don't have to sit and relish in it too much and don't have to, you know, manage the emotions of post conversations. It's now the amount of women that come to me and tell me their story. And I'm maybe the first or one of that first group. And I know what they're about to go through in understanding they've told somebody and hoping that they start to go get the help. They look for mental health professionals to go with them. They find these pockets of groups of women that unfortunately you're a part of this club that you never wanted to be a part of, but at least you're not alone in this experience. And I think the more and more we start being honest about what has happened, and I don't want to isolate this to women. Again, there are men that have been, you know, victims of this kind of behavior. If the more we can speak about trauma that is directly tied to the game, I think we're going to get to the core of what we actually can change, which is creating safe spaces for the athletes, for the coaching staff, for the training staff, for everybody. If we get some understanding that emotional intelligence, human resources, reporting hotlines that do the work to actually make investigations happen. If we start giving and empowering decision leaders to stop fearing the ramifications and retaliations of, I'm going to sue you for, you know, dismissing this coach who has allegations, get real that if there's a chance someone's reporting something, there's a good chance it's an actual story that's happened to someone and that the person is probably not going to change the behavior. So we've got to get real about this. And that part for me is the motivational factor when I've now heard all these stories from these women, that this is more rampant than any of us understand, that trauma by a coach or someone of power in a sexual, mental, physical, emotional way, that abuse is real. And it is so, so much a part of so many people's story in the game that it's tough to stomach sometimes. And so it is part of my healing is that I talk about it openly. I put it a piece of it, and it's hard because that takes its own individual toll, and I have to manage myself and my own emotions. But it is so important to this conversation that's coming out of yesterday's article about Roy Dames. I mean, I've seen it. I played against him. I was a player playing against his club. I knew when he was rising. I saw all of it. We heard all the rumors. Everyone was talking about it. So no shock to me. And it's kind of going, how did he get away with it? Well, I know, because people were so bent on what success looked like. And we're saying the sacrifices of success equal that, which is not it at all. And you hear, I love Kristen Press taking a mental health break after everything, because even the ones that hit the very highest in their sport, the USA Women's Gymnastics is an awesome example of that. And I hate to say awesome, but they are at the highest level. They've sacrificed everything and they push through it. And it's still, these traumas have a toll. They manifest eventually in some way, whether you see it or not, it comes out. And it's not a part of the sacrifice to get to the top level to be abused and just push through it. It's not, because it's not worth it. And so I think that's got to be part of the conversation as we move forward in this game about protecting the athletes, about protecting the coaching staff, because this is part of why we lose really good people in the game. And we don't know why sometimes. And we go, why did they leave? There might be something they'd never told us because they didn't feel safe to say it anywhere. So,
Candace, I just want to say thank you for sharing all that. That's an extraordinary story. And I am convinced that those who listen, whether they be victimized or not, your response will indeed resonate and hopefully, you know, help those who have been victimized and educate others to help those who might have been victimized. So I truly appreciate how forthright, how open and honest you've been. It means a great deal. And yeah, you mentioned Rory Dames. You know, he was, you know, this is years ago. Some of the, you know, the stuff that was taking place was terrible. And we see people like Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan, Crystal Dunn coming out very, very, very publicly criticizing U.S. soccer, for, as they talk about willful inaction, you know, in wake of the revelations, in the Washington Post story. So yeah, it's been going on for a very, very, very long time. So again, many thanks for that open, honest, answer. I really appreciate that. Let's get into Fearless and Capable. Let's dive into that, because it's wonderful. It's wonderful. So I don't want to steal your thunder. What is Fearless and Capable?
So it is, as you introduced it, a mentorship program at the heart. And so what I think is one of my strengths, and I talk to women a lot of times about being open and honest about their strengths and owning it, is that I'm a pretty process oriented person. So I look at, okay, here's our problem, our issue. How do we create a solution? What's the processes that we can put in place to get from point A to point B? And so when I looked at an issue, which is the absence of mentorship, the ability for experiences to be validated, for support when you're unsure or you're looking for feedback or guidance on, you know, pieces of the career field or pivoting and shifting within the career field specifically, you know, I was like, how can this happen? And honestly, I have been doing some work in Iowa and created, was a co-founder of the Iowa Women in Soccer Alliance. And we had done this on a very informal basis of offering our support, our services. We'll meet with you, we'll chat with you at any point in time. But I feel like it was always going through the leaders instead of actually getting straight to the women that were working there. And so what kind of came to light, and the pandemic was piece and part of that, was because we were all living virtually in connection. So I was like, well, that does provide a really solid tool. And so these processes and these ideas that I had on how do we connect women and give them the support when there is that absence of mentorship. And I want to clarify, it's not just the absence of mentorship. It's maybe the absence of relatable mentorship. I had phenomenal soccer coaching mentorship. I had phenomenal leader mentorship. Where I struggled was the relatability mentorship as being a woman, having a child, literally, you know, giving birth to a child, some of those relatable mentorship pieces. And so what it really is at the end of the day is two part. We have a membership program, and the membership is, you know, a platform that members can come in, they can network, they can connect to women all over the industry. It is not soccer specific, though soccer is a big portion of the membership right now. We have women's wrestling, we have softball entering, and lots of conversations in other sports as well, because I think there is a value to learning, you know, as all of us are working in the industry, ways and we can all improve specific to the sport, or maybe even just general sports, in the way we work it. But the membership really is this virtual log on your phone, on a computer. You have resources at your fingertips. We have workshop events every month hosted by mentors across the industry on skill sets, mindsets, different tips and tricks to be able to be successful in the long run. And I say be successful in the long run is not the title that you ultimately hold. It's that feeling of hitting what you want ideally for yourself in your career. And so how do you see what you're strong at being valued in what you're working at? Where do you see, you know, the challenges and limitations you have? How do you overcome those? How do you find yourself successful in an environment where you're having this free ability to work on those and then be supported in things that are limitations where you can't necessarily maybe improve them? You just have to find resources to support them. And so, you know, it's got book clubs. We have team huddles every month where, you know, we take that workshop event that our mentor has, you know, greatly provided knowledge and resources on, and we take it to these virtual, informal, not recorded team huddles where women can jump in and we have a topic, but we don't have a set agenda, and we can validate experiences. We can provide guidance, and you just don't know who's going to be on the call, which is kind of great because it's just people from different parts of the country with different backgrounds and lived experiences, different titles they're holding, different parts of the game they're involved in. And it's just really great because now you're getting in for 45 minutes and you don't know where it's going to take you. But my whole rule is that we can never sit in one space and just complain. There's always got to be this progress piece. So everyone kind of at the end is always responsible for one tidbit, something they've taken away, whether it's a idea, an action step, just something to think about, you know, so on. We've got to provide that movement forward, that next step forward. And that really comes out of the fact that, you know, the decision to call it Fearless and Capable had a few pieces. Is that the fearless part is that we own our fear. We accept the fact that we maybe don't know everything. We don't know what tomorrow holds. We might not know where we're going next. But despite the fears that we have, we still take that step forward. And that's a lot of times easier when you know you have the network. And that's where, you know, my own life experience is that fear of, can I make it in the industry? Can I be someone who values myself and my coaching? I kept taking steps forward, but that was a heck of a lot easier when I had people around me that supported me. And then the capable word comes with the fact that a mindset to achieve and be successful is great. That's a big piece of that. But I also know you got to be good. You got to still work on your abilities. And so, you know, being capable is not something that is a set in stone thing. We're capable here. We want to improve there. You know, my capabilities in this area are maybe limited. So what do I do in terms of giving resources to myself and acknowledging that this is something I struggle with, and being able to talk to people that can relate to that maybe and be able to give you ideas and tips. So the fearless and the capable are two words that honestly I try to live by. I own and I talk a lot more openly about my successes. And it's not because I want to boost an ego. I want to be a role model for women to start owning what they've achieved and stop diminishing or, you know, devaluing what they've done. And that is a big thing for a lot of women. I want them to be capable of saying yes, capable of saying no, understanding that boundaries are healthy. And when they get in environments where boundaries are not, you know, understood or valued or even completely ignored, that that's not a healthy environment for them, that there are spaces that will do that. Because that's a really big piece we're fighting right now is honestly, there's so many people living and working in spaces where boundaries are not respected. And it's just, well, this is just how it has to be. And I'm like, I call BS. Because I know clubs, I know college, I know programs and people running organizations that value that piece, that put the person above, you know, everything else and making sure. So I call BS on that because I want women to think about what they, in their mind, they see themselves doing, how they ideally want to treat themselves, how they ideally want to have the life around them, the communities they're a part of, the relationships they hold, and then how they ideally want to see their career fold out, not necessarily with a certain title, but the skill sets, the things they're doing, the challenges they want to face and have regularly in their lives. And we put all those together with this mindset of this is what I want to do. And then I build my capabilities and I put that and signed so, so big. Because I think there's so much of the language I know I've personally worked on and I work on a lot with our mentees and members is I can do this, but, or I think I could do this, but, and there's so much my buts in these conversations that it's, I think a big reason that when women look at themselves and they don't always see the representation, and it's getting better where we can see if I can see her, I can be her is more prevalent. But if I can get into a mindset where I understand who I want to be and the things I want to do, and I understand that I am a work in progress, I'm still working on these things I'm really great at and these things I want to be better at, and I can see myself moving in a direction in a positive way, whether or not I have that role modeling there, I'm going to get there. And I'm capable and I've got the mindset to do this for the long run. And that's the big thing I keep emphasizing is we've got to start putting and setting up ways that people are in this industry for the long run. And I think that's been more systematically done for white men than it has for anybody else. Like it works and it is acceptable for the way that in quotes, and I say that it, white men work. And I laugh because here's the other piece that's really interesting is I'm a part of a Moms Who Coach advocacy group through United Soccer Coaches, the women's advocacy group, this Moms Who Coach is kind of a branch out. And I keep talking and there's a lot of agreement. Like, what about parents who coach? What about dads who coach and that lifestyle and that thought process? And I love asking, and they won't talk about it in groups. Like, I don't know what it is, but I get a bunch of guys in a group and I'm like, who have you talked to about being a dad and coaching? And they're all like, oh, I don't know. And then you get them together or alone and they're like, no, this is really hard to be a dad. And I'm like, it's so taboo to talk about it. And I was on, you know, the regional staff in November with my husband. Like, my husband's standing next to me 90% of the time. And he saw it more than he's ever saw it. I was asked about the kids 99% of the time. And he was not asked really at all. And I know it's a common thing to ask about your life and your family, but it was just so prevalent that as a woman, those were the main questions to me was about my children. And he, the father of these said children, are also not being asked those questions. And so I just think about in a general way, like, how can we as people start talking about these very commonalities that we're not really discussing when it becomes this industry? And so by having Fearless and Capable be female led and female inspired, we're getting these topics more prevalent for women to have the opportunity to discuss, get opportunities too, and be a part of. But then at the same time, reaching across and finding allies in males and non-binary and saying, what are things that we're actually all relating on that have been taboo or have been things always discussed behind closed doors? Because it's not systematically set up for everybody else to really find success in. It's more systematically set up for white men to be this 24/7, you know, soccer coach, DOC, whatever it might be. And everyone accepts that that's just what it is when we're not even talking about how tough it is for a lot of those guys and the ones that we lose. And we're not talking about mental health when it comes to this. And it's more prevalent for women to talk about it, but not men. Why? Well, we're talking about it. How about you guys just join us and we all talk about it? And so that's kind of those mindsets of how we can do this. And I went on a tangent there, but the other piece of this whole program is the one-on-one mentoring. And that's where we pair up mentors and members and do very intentional agreements. So we know what we're working towards. It's not just a, hey, tell me what's been going on. How's life? It's very much of, you know, you're trying to get better at this. Awesome. As your mentor, I have a responsibility. I have accountability to you. I'm finding people, books, resources. I'm having questions I'm posing to you so that you feel like you're making progress towards what you ideally want. Right now, it's all female mentors, but there's definitely plans to add in male mentors because, again, I'm a product of male mentors in a lot of ways. So there's a lot of value, but I want to put out how many females are there and how many females are actually ready and willing to give back and make sure that their faces, their names are more prevalent. And we all would love a Brandi Chastain, you know, a Jill Ellis, like, great, but it's not a reality. And these women are already doing amazing things. Like, what about, in quotes, the real women doing the everyday that you don't see all the time, either on the convention floor or in, you know, in the courses? Like, there are women doing amazing work in the industry that have been doing this for years and have done great and amazing things. And their knowledge and their experiences are just as valid and just as important. And so getting them to see themselves as someone that can give back in a really good way has been exciting. And I'll leave it at this. These mentors are never people that go, yep, I'm a mentor and I am ready to bestow all of my knowledge. They're always like, can I get mentored too? Like, could I do both? I'm like, yes, because they're just so growth minded in their own progress and what they want to do personally. So it's really a fun thing because it dives into so many different ways that we can make this game a little bit better. And so there's just so many parts and pieces that are moving, but becoming a part of the membership is something that's very easy with a 30-day free trial where you can get into the system and the platform and become a member, see how our workshop events go, see how our team huddles go, see the courses that we offer virtually. And be able to start moving in a direction that you're really excited about personally and professionally.
So I'm going to pull out two or three things here out of your response here. One of them is already part of my show notes here. Was it a conscious or just by accident aspect that, you know, your team huddles, your one-on-one mentoring became therapy sessions? When you were laying this all out, did the word therapy or therapeutic go through your mind in formulating the one-on-one mentoring and the team huddles, or it just kind of organically on your own became, hey, you know what? This is just good therapy.
There was some thought that this is where this will lean towards. And to be frank and honest, my mom is, like I said earlier, in the mental health field, and she's regularly doing therapy. And so I have that, already within kind of my environment. And so I have given a lot of time, you know, with her and others in the mental health field to really understand what that one-on-one experience looks like. But it is, I mean, I think that is a component, but I think that's real. If you went through our program or you find a mentor that you trust, it's about creating this rapport, this safe space where you can say, this is where I'm at, this is what I'm going through, or this is something I want to do. And a mentor is there to say, cool, these are some ideas, these are some tips, this is some guidance, these are some things I think you could do. Here are ways that maybe I've done it and I've had success, so maybe you want to go try it. I'm a firm believer that a mentor is someone who sits between your reflection and your decisions. So I cannot reflect for you. You reflect, you share, and I can give you thoughts, guidance. I can challenge reflections, but it's your lived experiences and you see them as you experience them. And then you're going to make the decision. I'm not making it for you. I'm going to give you ways to think about the next decision. I'm going to give you people to talk to because I've maybe been in that network. So I can say, hey, you might want to talk to these people because they're doing this or they had this experience. It'd be wise to just get their opinion on things. And so as a mentor, we're sitting in this asking a lot of questions, giving sometimes the most direct feedback that they need to hear, positive, maybe not so positive sometimes. I think that is a big piece that has some therapeutic type behaviors, but we're really intentional with our mentors because we don't just, you know, give you a mentee as a mentor and say, hey, go be wonderful. We support our mentors with monthly calls and continuing education, and there's onboard training and so on. So they're not just, hey, you're great and wonderful, go do it. It's intentional, but also, you know, a lot of last year was about honestly being trauma informed because, again, when I've started to be open and honest, you know, not every story that comes to me is about a sexual abuse. It runs the gamut of abuse or things that happen, that have trauma tied to the experiences they've had in sport, whether it's as a player, and it might have been a family issue where dad or mom were doing certain things, which then, you know, manifested on the field, so on. And so, you know, being really cognizant that as mentors and people creating trust and rapport and being a safe space for these mentees, there is a chance they will share something that has trauma associated to it. So as people that are taking on this important role, becoming trauma informed, and I know in the education field, this is, you know, something very well known. It is not, and it needs to be a part of the soccer industry. It needs to be a part of the people running clubs. It needs to be a part of, you know, college programs and getting the understanding that more and more, if we all start looking at the realities, you are probably hiring someone who has some sort of trauma that is directly tied to the game, which can impact how they coach, how they work, how they view their colleagues, how they may work with you as a director. And I can tell you my personal experiences when I have informed most people that I work for that this is part of it or part of my story, they struggle to look me in the eye. They visibly become uncomfortable that I'm talking about it. So then I'm sitting there going, well, I'm sorry, I'm making everybody uncomfortable, so I should maybe stop talking. Instead, I've flipped the narrative and going, we all need to talk about it because I'm not the only one that this has happened to, or, you know, in some form or fashion. And so I think that is a big piece, is that our mentors are that way. They have trauma-informed training, and getting our industry to realize that is actually a really important piece. So not only are we creating opportunities for mentees and members and women entering the industry or maybe re-entering the industry after leaving, we also are setting up mentors and leaders of the game to have these other skill sets beyond all the wonderful, amazing capabilities they're already bringing to their role within the game currently.
So I want to tackle just a couple other areas before we kind of draw this to a close. We use the word mentor, mentoring, in navigating your website and learning all of what you're doing. You have an amazing group of mentors. It's a wonderful collection of folks from across the professional spectrum. Talk to my audience about some of the mentors you have, because it's indeed an amazing group, and your partnerships. How does the partnership work with Fearless and Capable and those who have formal partnerships with you?
Yeah. So fearlessandcapable.com, you know, gives a lot of overviews of what the programming looks like and then ways to directly connect with me. Anybody looking to do a one-on-one, your first stop is me, and we connect on a 30-minute call just to chat about where you're at. And then from there, work on pairing you up with mentors. And like you alluded to, we've got, you know, people like Janae Bukowski, who are leading state associations in a technical way. We've got college coaches in the Division I level, from like an Erica Demers to, you know, women that are working Division II, Division III, head coaches, assistant coaches. We've got DOCs of clubs. So, you know, running the high level clubs to small, like Yolanda Thomas out of Tulsa. We have women that are coming aboard that, you know, have Olympic experience in the wrestling field. And so they're college coaches or they're running national programs. And, you know, these are women that I encourage our members. And it's kind of funny because the convention, though, you know, a little bit more intimate than normal based off numbers and attendance, some of the members that were there ran into mentors in the program. And it was just an easy way and a great point for them to connect and go, oh, you're in Fearless and Capable. And so there's this natural introduction point and a connection and relatability that's very cool. And so I'm always looking for more mentors. It is something I'm actively in the space of doing. But I always am cognizant of, you know, what time they can give and what skill sets they have. I want a diverse group of lived experiences of, you know, cultures and so on. So this is a very intentional process. And I honestly look at style of mentoring. My style of what I enjoy in being mentored and mentoring works for some and doesn't for others. And so I'm not biased to creating, you know, a whole bunch of like styled, you know, mentors of my own personal, like it's definitely a vetting process of ways that you like to teach and learn. And that process goes down to the members when we do the one-on-ones. And so that's a really big piece that, you know, you don't necessarily get to always pick your mentor because some of this is availability on their side. But it's definitely an intentional process that's not just, hey, you want a mentor? Great. What level are you at? It's a lot more in depth to do those pairings. And that's because these women are going to give you time and energy. And I want to make sure both get, you know, the most out of it as possible. And then, you know, looking to partnering on a, you know, governing body level, such as a state association, or, you know, another organization that's overseeing leagues or clubs, you know, definitely the opportunities that the partnerships are, I think they're at a low cost, because what I actually want you to do is turn around and help invest. And so we talk a lot about getting and using your finances to pay for memberships, to pay for one-on-one sessions, because again, it's that passing the marker. Go back to that metaphor. If someone looks at you and says, hey, I think you could really do this and be great, you're usually, as just a natural human being, like, oh, cool, I appreciate it. Oh, by the way, here's something to take part in because I think it could grow and help you be better. You tend to take a little bit more advantage, or at least a more consideration of looking at that opportunity. First person to say, go to the convention. I was like, what's the convention? First person to say, you should take coaching education. I'm like, wait, there's what? There's coaching education. It's not just go to the field. Like, there's actual ways I can learn. This is another format of that. And so these state associations, and then honestly with the clubs as well, getting discounts and ways to put your female staff in this program and find opportunity for relatable mentorship. It might be, you know, again, through a membership or through one-on-one sessions that you can take a portion of the cost, all of the cost away for her and get her into the program. But it's really about where you're at to financially support and reinvest in your staff. And then the other part is that I think about building your bench. When you look at the people that are going to take over this club, this program, whatever it may be, this association, when you look at that, those groups of people that are in, how diverse is that looking right now? How much are the lived experiences so similar, and maybe so similar to you, that any sort of ideas that are coming down the pipeline from these individuals about what the future can hold are so similar to you that you might be missing the boat on what the next steps can be for your group? And so we talk a lot about, as this is a tool to help actually attract and retain different people with different lived experiences, and namely women, to your organization by not only investing in them, but also saying, listen, I'm in it for the long run. I hope you are too. I want you to have these opportunities to be, you know, growing and seeing yourself with this organization in the long term. And you're honestly, as an organization, building your bench when you invest in these types of partnerships. So
last but not least, if people wanted to learn more about Fearless and Capable, they wanted to learn more about Candace Fabry, they wanted to contact you, what's the best way to go about doing all of that?
So fearlessandcapable.com, there's a way to directly contact me through the website there. Candace@fearlessandcapable.com is my email address. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's @fearlesscapable. And then @Candace Fabry. And so, yeah, both are open. The Candace Fabry tends to be some more of the mom shots and all that kind of stuff. And then the Fearless and Capable is really geared towards mentoring and thoughts and ideas to have as you're maybe approaching your day, or, you know, knowing about different opportunities that are coming up. So it's, yeah, two different versions, but both are ways to easily get a hold of me. And yeah, that's the contact piece, definitely.
Well, Candace, this has been an absolutely enlightening conversation. As I noted to you at the outset, when we first started our conversation, I was looking forward to having this conversation because I was learning all of this for the first time in all of my show preparation. And the more I dove into it, the more I learned, and the more notes that I wrote down, the more enthusiastic I became to having you on. And again, this has just been an absolutely enlightening conversation. And I do indeed encourage folks to look into it and to learn more and to get involved. So Candace, I want to thank you so much for taking the time for being on the GP Soccer Podcast.
I appreciate it. And thank you for creating these types of spaces for these conversations, because the X's and the O's are so important to us making the game better. But I also think, you know, starting to be more honest about what circles the game in a lot of ways, good and bad, we need to start putting on the table and having conversations about. So I appreciate you giving me this space to do that. So thank you.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. So this is the GP Soccer Podcast. My goodness, you all know that. I'm Giovanni Piccini, your able host. Well, I think I'm able. We're going to break for a commercial message or two, and we're going to reconnect on the other side and talk more about my conversation with Candace Faber. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Are you a professional woman looking to gain the confidence necessary to grow both personally and professionally? Wouldn't it be great to know that there is a terrific resource and outstanding mentors to help guide you on your journey? Fearless and Capable is a female-owned and led membership program focused on creating impactful women to lead sport organizations into a more successful and inclusive future. Its mission is to bring consistent and impactful mentoring and provide the resources necessary so as to support females in all sports-related fields. Membership in Fearless and Capable focuses on providing relatable mentorship for women in sports careers through a number of ways, including, but not limited to, member-only access to a platform with self-paced development courses, monthly virtual events, networking opportunities, and one-on-one accountability-driven mentoring sessions. With over 40 mentors on board, this diverse group stretches across the spectrum of sporting careers, each with experiences of success and struggle to relate and support you. Join Fearless and Capable with a free 30-day trial membership at www.fearlessandcapable.com and be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, at Fearless Capable, and on Instagram, at Fearless_Capable.
Number One Soccer Camps is literally America's number one specialty soccer camp, featuring camps for goalkeepers, strikers, teams, and college showcase camps. With 45 years of continuous operation, Number One Soccer Camps are featured at locations with exceptional facilities, showcasing superb playing surfaces, accommodations, and dining amenities. Staff members are a virtual who's who in American soccer, as well as outstanding international staff coaches. With over 90,000 graduates, Number One Soccer Camps include MLS goalkeepers, leading players on both the U.S. men and women's national teams, as well as countless others who have received athletic financial aid to play soccer at American colleges and universities. Campers will enjoy 3+ field sessions daily, each ending with an appropriate positional competition between field players and goalkeepers, with the focus on the intrinsic values of play. Number One Soccer Camps feature a small, adjustable group learning structure which is based on age, size, and ability, with continual movement between groups as abilities develop and mature. Competitive tournaments are played throughout the week and will be the highlight of the evening sessions. Players will have the opportunity to compete against other teams, against other players, Dutch tournament, and against themselves in pressure training. Goalkeepers will also participate in goalie wars, penalty contests, breakaway contest, and in World Cup. Through this exciting, motivating, and inspirational program, each participant receives a comprehensive 75-point camper evaluation and development plan. Don't wait. Sign up today. To learn more about Number One Soccer Camps, visit numberonesoccercamps.com. That's N-O, the number one, soccercamps.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Bob Mewis, father of Christy and Sam Mewis of the United States Women's National Soccer Team. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Piccini.
And welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I'm your host, Giovanni Piccini. Many thanks to Candace Fabry, the founder and owner of Fearless and Capable, for coming on the show. I'm quite certain, ladies and gentlemen, that those of you who listen to the show, listen to the conversation, listen to the interview, could not have helped to have been moved, to be enlightened. I tip my cap and give a great deal of credit to Candace for sharing her personal story. These are issues that are very difficult to talk about. Never mind putting it out there on a podcast, on a radio show such as this one. But I give her a lot of credit for sharing that. Not only, you know, sharing her story, but taking action and putting together Fearless and Capable. So again, many thanks to Candace. You know, I mentioned at the opening block of the show these issues of inappropriate behavior in the NWSL. You know, we're investigated and hopefully going forward, particularly in the NWSL, but not just in the NWSL, but, you know, in every type of athletic environment, that when young athletes step on the field, boys or girls for that matter, boys or girls, when they step on the athletic field, they step on the soccer field, they should feel safe. They should feel protected. Certainly the top of that list relative to, you know, ensuring safety and protection is the coach, and the coach is. And so were there any lessons learned in what happened in the NWSL and what happened in the situation with Candace? We now know that we've got to have people who are the care and concern of their athletes is always the foremost of their thought processes and their behavior. So lessons learned. So that's our show for today. If you like what you heard, please tell everyone. You can follow the GP Soccer Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Linktree. And let's not forget my website at gp-soccer.com. This is your host, Giovanni Pacini, and I'll catch you later.